It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Congressional staff investigating the widening General Motors ignition switch recall over 2 million vehicles, recall of over 2 million vehicles, said there are indications GM approved the design of the switches in 2002, even though the company knew they did not meet specifications. We'll discuss that story and more coming up here on the program. But first, according to some lawmakers and patient advocates, the nation's mental health care system is broken. One of them is Pittsburgh area Republican Congressman Tim Murphy. He's proposing a sweeping overhaul, increasing accessibility to care while expanding the use of involuntary treatment and allowing family members and caregivers to intervene in cases involving the severely mentally ill. The bill, called the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, has drawn mixed reviews from House members and mental health providers and patients, including some who testified at a hearing of the House Energy and Commerce Committee last week. I'm joined now by phone from Washington by Representative Tim Murphy, who is also a clinical psychologist. Congressman Murphy, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
This hearing came a day after another mass shooting at Fort Hood, Texas, and 2 days after police said a McCandless woman killed her two children by submerging them in the bathtub after hearing voices. You have said that your bill might have prevented those incidents. How so?
Well, because what happened in those cases and the other tragedies, and there's many other filicides where a mom kills a child. I mean, thousands of these around the country where there's harm that appears like that, and many of these other mass shooting tragedies, is that these are people with severe mental illness, of which there's 10 million or so folks in the nation who suffer from that. About half of them are not even aware that they have a problem. That is extremely important to understand. And you have about over 3 million people with severe mental illness who are not getting treatment. If they were to receive treatment, it is important to note this, although most people with mental illness are nonviolent, those who are getting treatment are 15 times less likely, those who are in treatment are 15 times less likely to be involved in some violent aspect. And so when we look at those who have been involved in these cases, what you find inevitably is someone who is not identified or not getting treatment or getting treatment that was not adequate or not appropriate. So when you look at this mom, I don't know what kind of treatment she's getting. I understand that she's found not competent to stand trial. When you look at the case that appeared at Fort Hood or go all the way back to Sandy Hook Elementary School, you repeatedly find someone who was struggling, oftentimes hallucinating, oftentimes with a few serious emotional problems. We need to get them the help that's available. But the standard right now is the standard of imminent danger. That is, unless you find that a person is almost literally with a knife to their own throat or someone else's, you cannot get them help. There are some states like New York who have something called assisted outpatient treatment where they don't wait till the person has crossed the threshold of danger. But if a person has, for example, a background of multiple hospitalizations or hasn't been staying in treatment and they're in serious safety problems or they've been in and out of prison, states like New York can actually work with the patient, negotiate with them, and get them to stay on their medication, get them to stay in treatment. Now, that's a far better alternate than what we have going on now, where either you have to commit someone to a hospital or they're in jail. Our jails, tragically, about 30 to 50% of people in jail are folks with mental illness. And it is a sad report in America that while we have done the right thing in terms of closing our mental asylums in this country, because many of them were just awful, awful places, we've traded the hospital bed for a jail cell or a homeless shelter or, in a sad state of affairs, many times death through homicide or through suicide. Last year in this country, over 41,000 suicide deaths and over a million suicide attempts. So the statistics are staggering in terms of what happens to folks, and I believe had the perpetrators in these cases been getting help before, these crimes most likely would not have happened.
Explain the evolution of this legislation, Congressman, which, as I understand it, you started putting together after the Sandy Hook Elementary School tragedy in 2012.
Yes. I'm the chairman of the Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee. And in that committee, we held a series of hearings over the last year. We had parents, testify. We had experts testify. We had people from the, doctors and people who are deeply involved in the mental health system testify. And they told us in many cases there's huge barriers to getting help. Not enough psychiatrists, not enough psychologists. Medicaid billing doesn't pay for if someone sees two doctors the same day. Medicaid won't pay if the hospital is more than 16 beds. Confidentiality laws, which are often misunderstood, so doctors do not involve the parents in gathering history and background. I mean, on this last point, let me say, what a shame it is that because of misunderstandings with the law, and it needs to be clarified, and our bill does that, because of misunderstandings, many times a doctor will refuse to talk to parents who are saying, look, my child's out of control, they're hallucinating, they're struggling, and the doctors say, no, confidentiality laws mean I can't talk to you. But in the meantime, the parents can't even be told when their child has an appointment, what medications they are on. And to say that we cannot gather the history for psychiatric patients is wrong, because history is essential to diagnosis. You have to have accurate background. And it's like telling an orthopedic surgeon you're not allowed to look at an X-ray for someone with a broken arm or you're suspected. So those are some of the points we came up with, but many more. Police were not receiving adequate training. We don't even have an adequate count of number of folks in federal prisons that their crimes are directly related to mental illness and what would happen if they got treatment. What happens with those who are in prisons who, when they emerge, are they continuing with treatment? The biggest psychiatric facilities in this country, the biggest ones, are jails. The Los Angeles County Jail, the Cook County Jail in Illinois, and the list goes on and on. So this is what we heard repeatedly from people, that the problems with the system is the system itself, and we have to make sure that money gets with evidence-based care to the people that need it, not eaten up in Washington or other programs, other places where it's not getting the care, and really make those things work.
We're talking by phone from Washington with Representative Tim Murphy, who is also a clinical psychologist, and I think you might have outlined some of this already for us, Congressman, but what are your own experiences as a clinical psychologist telling you about what needs to be done?
Well, I know that I have worked with thousands of patients myself over the years and wrote books on anger, one called The Angry Child and another one on passive-aggressive anger. And I work also in the Navy right now. I'm a lieutenant commander in the Navy Reserve, and I work at Walter Reed Hospital with soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. And I realize time and time again that we know we've had huge changes in medications that help people with severe mental illness. We know that there's therapeutic approaches and change that have helped. We know that using services where people who themselves are in recovery, who are now stable from their past episodes of schizophrenia and bipolar, can be immensely supportive and very helpful to involve them in treatment. Because many times you have a person with schizophrenia who is paranoid and fearful of what's going on, but if they can be helped in addition to the medication and other supportive therapies by someone else who says, you know, I've been there, I've gotten better, this can work. That recovery model can be very, very helpful. That peer support model can be helpful. But we also need hospital beds. So we learned throughout all of this that I've learned that people can get better. But if there's no help, there isn't any hope.
We know that there's support for this, but what about the concerns that have been expressed by some that this bill takes away the rights of individuals, including their rights to choose their treatment?
Well, look, I get it that the groups that who receive all their funding for doing the same thing, they want to keep their funding. But let's face it, the status quo just isn't working. And I fully expect those groups that want to keep things the way they are to rebel against that. But my job is to make sure that this system changes. And the outpouring of concerns we've heard from people throughout the nation, and I get emails and calls daily on this, it will break your heart when they say that they just cannot get the help. So, of course, these groups want to keep things going, but we can't keep reading about more tragedies of suicides and deaths and people who are left homeless or people who are in jail. The status quo is failing, period. And lives are lost because we keep doing what isn't working. So what our bill says is for some people who are not complying with their treatment, but who are unsafe and have had a history of some problems with jail or repeated hospitalizations. For that 1%, that less than 1%, we're saying we want states to at least have a law on the books where they can work with these families besides putting them in jail, besides having involuntary commitment to say, you can stay out of the hospital, but you got to get on medication, you got to get in treatment. Now, there is evidence, there's scientific evidence that says this works. In New York State, they've reduced jail sentences for the mentally ill by 87%. They've reduced homelessness by 70-plus percent. They've reduced emergency room visits by 70-plus percent. And this emergency room issue is extremely important, because what so often happens is someone is picked up. Maybe they're argumentative. Maybe they've been shoplifting. Maybe they're wandering around the streets. Maybe they're hallucinating. They don't know who they are, where they are, what planet they're on. And the police pick them up, bring them to an emergency room. Emergency rooms don't have beds for these folks. And what they'll say is, unless this person's going to kill somebody, we can't keep them. But in the meantime, they'll try and stabilize them. And here's what happens. They'll give them medications to basically reduce their agitation. They'll tie them to a hospital bed. They may remain there for days, multiple days. That is inhumane to me, that's the best we can offer people. So the groups that say keep things as they are, the status quo, I say families are suffering, people are dying, because we keep doing what isn't working. And I'm going to change the status quo, and we're going to save lives in doing so.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Congressman Tim Murphy about his bill, the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act. And we're going to switch gears here a bit, because I know it's been a busy week for you, Representative Murphy. You also chair the Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee, which puts you at the center of the hearings involving the GM recall issues. What do you make of the information collected through documents and briefings?
Well, what we found out is that General Motors, several years, I think 2004, had information that their ignition switch system was not meeting their own specifications. And what that means is it takes a certain amount of strength, just a little bit, to turn a key on and to turn it off. What they discovered was something as simple as you have a couple extra keys in your keychain, or bumping the key with your knee, the car would shut off. It would go from on position to accessory position. They discovered this, but we found documents that said it was not cost-effective to change it. It didn't make a business case. And so they continued to produce this car, and then we found out they changed the part but kept the same part number, put the new part in the newer Chevy Cobalts, did not recall the old Cobalts. In the meantime, they also found that some of these cars had airbags that didn't deploy, and the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, the government agency that's supposed to protect our safety, also found there were some problems with airbag deployment. But NHTSA studied this twice and said they weren't going to go further with any further investigations. And General Motors was themselves perhaps not communicating within their own offices. So last week we had Mary Barra, the CEO of General Motors, come before a committee. And I got to tell you, what we heard from them was disturbing. One, she didn't study. Of course, I understand it's 200,000 pages of documents. But you'd think they at least would have briefed her on these key components where they said it wasn't cost-effective, didn't make a business case. She was aware, and she said it was inexcusable, the decision that was made almost a decade ago by someone to not change the part number, to still put this part in that didn't meet their specifications. I understand she was in charge at that time, but GM has a long way to go here, as does NHTSA, to change this system to restore public confidence.
Well, most recalls are voluntary. But in 2010, a bill that would have strengthened the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration was defeated, and that measure would have reduced the government's reliance on the industry to self-report, to do these things or make these recalls voluntarily. Is that what is needed here?
Well, no, there was a bill called the TREAD Act, which passed several years ago when there was an issue with Toyota cars and also with the tires and, excuse me, not Toyota, but with the Firestone tires. And it's very clear that when there's some problems, they have 5 days to notify NHTSA. And there was other things that should have been passed on with this. And there are penalties, including millions of dollars in fines, up to $35 million, I believe, and criminal penalties for not passing it on. What happens here is, you know, we continue to talk about the issue with increasing penalties, doing other things, but it's pretty clear is that there was problems that occurred at GM, and they saw some of it. In fact, they even said, use this quote, blowing up in GM's face, unquote, that GM was aware of. And they should have been making some reports, I believe, to more with NHTSA. But NHTSA had a lot of this data, too, and they weren't responding to this. So it is an issue of how NHTSA reviews this information and what else GM should have passed on and how they handle that. So that's part of where we're going. I should say that as I go further with this investigation, and we are not done, the facts will tell us what else we need to do legislatively for this. There were some laws on the books, but I really want to make that part of our investigation, too, to see if we need to do more.
And in the meantime, on Saturday Night Live, you may have caught the opening skit of the show was a parody of the hearings, and they had one of the more popular cast members, Taryn Killam, portraying you, Congressman Murphy, as you oversaw the hearings. Did you catch the skit? What did you think of it?
I did. It was a funny skit, and it was one that it made a parody of our serious questioning. But Mary Barr's answers are basically saying, "We're going to look into that. We're going to study that." That was the old GM, but now the new GM. It's pretty funny. I hope people go online and take a look at that. I know we have a link on my I think on my Facebook page too. But it was humorous. It was funny to see this character playing me, saying live from New York. It's Saturday night. Not something I ever would have expected, but there it is.
It was very interesting, and yeah, we would encourage people to go online and see if what we're talking about if you didn't actually see it live on Saturday night. Congressman Tim Murphy joining us by phone from Washington. Great. Thanks for your time, sir.
Thank you, and we'll keep informing you as developments emerge on these two issues.
We appreciate that.
Bye-bye now.
Coming up, we'll talk more about the GM recall issues with Los Angeles Times writer Jerry Hirsch. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.